Lacey made it her life's work to make dreams come true for the children she sees every day as a theme park princess. But when her own happy ending goes south, she doesn't know that just around the corner is a real-life fairy tale all her own. I'm Heather Songster, and this is Hopelessly Romantic. Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to another episode. I am so very glad to be back after our time off, and I'm ready to dive right back in. Today's novel is, well, something I never expected to see. I found it on a day where I had an impulsive trip into the bookstore. I wasn't looking for anything special, I just wanted to look around. I did wander around the romance section, though, see if there was anything that I could put on my list for the future, when I came across two books. We will see the other book in the next episode, I promise, but the first one I found was, to put it mildly, unexpected. First of all, it comes from Hallmark. Yes, that Hallmark. The one famous for cards and bad Christmas movies that we all seem to love for some reason. I would usually pass on this publisher for the reputation alone. If I thought Harlequin was as spicy as Bran Flake cereal, there is no way Hallmark would come up to snuff. But I like what I like, and it drew me in with the title, Once Upon a Royal Summer by Terry Wilson. We all know that I am a sucker for royal tales, and I couldn't help myself. After reading the back blurb, I knew I wouldn't be leaving the store without it. Our story features a young woman who works as a princess at the top Florida theme park resort. This is significant because at one time, I myself worked at such an establishment. Yes, my big dark secret is that I am a former cast member who toiled away from the most powerful mouse on the planet. While I never donned a crown, I was too large for that, I filled a number of roles at the resort and have an intimate knowledge of how that whole operation works. So our review today might actually come from two separate angles. First, I'll be doing my usual review and critique on how this fits as a romance novel. And second, I'll be observing the interpretation of life as a once-upon-a-time theme park cast member. I will try to rein in the comparisons as best as I can. Obviously, they cannot be an exact replica, and I'm not going to sit here and point out every inaccuracy, but I will make note of certain plot points, because the author clearly did her homework on that most magical of kingdoms, and there are moments where she threw out well-established rules in order for her story to work the way that it does. Again, I will try to rein myself in, but for some reason, I have strong opinions on this particular topic, and there is a very real risk of running into a tangent. Now, I've gone on long enough about this, so let's take a look at Once Upon a Royal Summer. And I really have to admit, I like this cover. It's already hitting it out of the park with the color theory, pairing a teal background with our model wearing a golden gown. If I had to give a one-to-one comparison on the dress, it looks the most like Belle's ball gown from Beauty and the Beast, and might have even come from a pattern that was meant to emulate it. We only see the bottom half of the model's face, with a bright smile and cherry pink lips, and her hair drapes over her shoulders in blonde cascades. In one hand, she's holding a cotton candy on a stick, I'm guessing to help suggest the theme park concept. Like a few novels we've seen, we have the title in large white letters overlaid on the image, with Royal written in big, loopy calligraphy. Inside the pages, we meet Lacey Pope, as she meets up with her, quote, unofficial fiancé Mark Cooper. He quips that he didn't realize he'd be dining with royalty tonight, signaling to Lacey that she forgot to take her tiara off again. We are only one page in, and this had my eyebrows up already. For one thing, it was a good reminder for me that this was a fictional theme park with different rules. Like I mentioned before, the author had done her homework as far as the lives of cast members were concerned. She calls them cast members. But certain things were fiddled with for the sake of the story. This is one such instance. While I, as a non-entertainment cast member, could wear my uniform out and about in Orlando, no matter how strange it looked, entertainment and face characters do not get such privileges. This is really because the powers that be up in that castle are obsessed with brand integrity. I was only able to wear my costume in the real world because it was understood that I often had errands that needed to be run after work, and I was expected to behave myself. And it was a heck of a lot simpler than trying to get a new costume in my size every day before work. It's exhausting. As far as us regular cast members were concerned, being able to wear our costumes home and launder them ourselves was a matter of simplicity and convenience. Not so with the character actors. You aren't going to see someone dragging their princess dress home with them, nor would you see them wandering home with a tiara in their hair. The princesses are all wearing wigs anyway, so leaving that on trying to get home is basically a never-going-to-happen situation. For me, Lacey forgetting to take off her tiara is an interesting moment. Because I know that I would never see this happen in real life, I immediately understood that the author was trying to tell me something, and she was doing it via my favorite tool, Show, Don't Tell. Lacey is devoted to her job, almost religiously. This is also realistic, because a good portion of those cast members, from princesses to plebeians like me, are devoted much like the congregation of a church. It certainly wasn't the money keeping us there, I can promise you that. Lacey ties herself to her princess role so completely that the tiara isn't a second thought to her. It's happened before, according to the narration. She was even a little late to dinner because she'd been held up with a Make-A-Wish family. To really hammer home the concept, a couple of kids see her at the table and make the logical jump to, OMG, it's a real-life princess. So to start, we've got Lacey, who loves her job, loves kids, and lives and breathes the role that lets her enjoy both. And her guy, Mark, doesn't seem like he wants to put up with this for much longer. They've been talking about getting engaged, but something is nagging at Lacey on that front. From my point of view, I'm surprised that she and Mark are a thing. From the sound of it, he's from a wealthy family, navigating the world of the rich with ease, while Lacey seems to flounder behind him, hoping to pick the right fork at dinner. I'm not sure where she found this guy, but I don't see this lasting much longer than the chapter. My relationship senses start ringing even louder when he talks to her about what she wants to do once her time as Princess Sweet Pea is finished. He picks at her age, 27, telling her that she can't play the princess forever, and while he's not wrong, it's a lousy way to tell her to hurry up. Obviously, she doesn't take to his attack very well. Even if he's laying out possibilities for her, even ones that she might like, getting a teaching certificate or getting a board position with one of her favorite charities, he's also delegitimizing what it is that she's doing right now. No one takes to that sort of thing kindly, theme park performer or not. Clearly, we've got a case of incompatible kids here, and Lacey knows it. As she leaves Mark behind in the restaurant, he calls after her, saying that they could have been great together, and the crown on her head was fake, and that there's no such thing as fairy tales. Our perspective then shifts to the hero of our story, Crown Prince of Bellemoritz, Henry Frederick Augustus Rainier Chevalier. Quite the mouthful, and mercifully, we can just call him Henry. He's keeping an eye on his 6-year-old daughter as best as he can without showing himself, as she prepares for her riding lesson. Here we get a 2-for-1 special on our tropes, horses and dead women. The current problem for the prince is that Princess Rose had fallen off her pony when it spooked, and she had broken her arm. Even though she's healed up, now she's terrified of getting back on, which is a problem, since in 2 weeks, tradition dictated that she ride in the royal procession for the upcoming flower festival, now that she'll be turning 7 in a couple weeks, and therefore ready for her official debut. A lot of pressure for a little kid, royal or not. And hey, after falling from a couple of times from horses myself, I get it. It shakes you in ways that I don't think a lot of non-equestrians realize, and I didn't really fully understand that until I got thrown last year. Dead women makes itself known when we learn that 4 years later, Henry's wife had passed away, tearing a hole in both himself and Rose. Henry had done his absolute best to give Rose some sense of normalcy, as much as could be afforded a princess who had lost her mother, including attending public school and planning a small vacation in celebration of her upcoming birthday. We also meet Henry's mother, the current queen of Bellemoritz, and she is not a fan of how things have been going. She insists that Rose needs to have private tutors in the palace, and certainly shouldn't be going away anywhere when there's still so much work to be done in terms of her debut. She tells him that going to America is not in Rose's best interest, but Henry has his doubts. 3 days earlier, he'd found Rose propped up in bed, watching a movie on her iPad when he'd gone up to her room to kiss her goodnight. The film had been set at a theme park, complete with spinning teacups instead of high tea at the palace, sausage on a stick instead of fancy royal dinners, and Rose had been transfixed. She'd been as awestruck by the imitation, garish fairy tale world as tourists to Bella Moritz were by the sight of the very real castle in which she lived. Something had stirred inside Henry then, something he hadn't felt for quite a long time. Hope. Set in his determination to give Rose a proper childhood, Henry insists on making the trip. Catching back up with Lacey, as she's getting ready for her shift as Princess Sweet Pea, she's talking with her friend Ava about the breakup. Like any good friend, Ava listens and gives her friend support, and we get an additional look at Lacey's mood. While the breakup sucked, she knows that they simply weren't meant to be. For now, Princess Sweet Pea has more pressing matters to attend to, like hosting a tea party for 50 of her closest friends. The event in question is Sweet Pea's Royal Tea Party, and it sounds like a hot ticket attraction. Essentially, it's exactly what it sounds like. High tea with Princess Sweet Pea in the Royal Castle. I've concluded that Sweet Pea is a sort of Cinderella stand-in, given her status as premier princess in the park, and elements of the Cinderella story mixed in with the show at the tea party. Obviously, the author can't use Cinderella, so she's taken the Princess and the Pea fairy tale, stirred in some glass slippers and midnight curfews, and voila, Princess Sweet Pea. The tea party is not unlike some character dining opportunities, just with a lower admission rate. The tea party was pretty routine for Lacey. While the guests were always different, she knew the gig by heart, but today, oh, it was different. She walks up to a table with only two guests, indicating that they reserved the whole table typically meant for 10. Unusual, but not unheard of, and Lacey is immediately charmed by the young girl. For me, hilarity ensues, because to cast members, every little girl is a princess unless the little girl corrects you that she's actually maybe a pirate or otherwise. So Lacey appropriately asks the child, "What's your name, princess?" Right on cue, Rose tells her that she is Her Royal Highness Princess Rose, and we can see her father, who we now know to be Henry, gently correct her that there's no title, just Rose. Like, dude, do you know where you are? As far as Lacey knows, Rose is living out her imagination, talking about castles and royalty with real-life princesses. So watching Henry's discomfort is hugely entertaining for me, and it seems so for Lacey. She just thinks he's a grump who wouldn't know royalty from dishwater. We watch Henry as he equates what Princess Sweet Pea tells them about what being a princess is like with his own life back home, finally settling in that the whole point in coming here was to give Rose some make-believe and fun. He'd even come a little earlier than intended, just to give her time before they were descended upon by VIP guides and possibly paparazzi. As Henry listens to Princess Sweet Pea's almost absurd rules of being a princess, making friends with birds and butterflies, taking bubble baths with your crown, she throws out a curveball for her last rule, to always be kind. It tugs at his heartstrings a little bit, and starts to relax and maybe even enjoy just being Rose's dad. Lacey's a little rattled by Grumpy Baseball Cap Dad, that's what she calls him, but she doesn't let it show as she finishes her rounds and has the customary waltz with her assigned Prince Charming for the day. She's the expert dancer between the two of them, but then again, she loves being Princess Sweet Pea. Once her dance is over, it's time to teach whoever wants to learn how to do the waltz. She gets 9 volunteers, but they have room for 10, when something catches her eye. Grumpy Ball Cap sort of smirks, so she puts them on the spot to join the dance lessons. Now, Lacey is bluffing to a point. She's not going to force him to dance if he doesn't want to, but Little Rose insists, and he relents. She teaches all the volunteers how to waltz, and then everyone gets paired up, and she pairs herself with Grumpy Ball Cap. However, it doesn't go the way she expected. So this was what it felt like to really waltz? To be led across the dance floor by someone who knew what he was doing? After 5 years of practice, this dance felt like it was what Lacey had been preparing for all this time. The real deal. The strangest thing of all was that Grumpy Baseball Cap never looked down at his feet or let his gaze wander over her shoulder to see where they were going. Instead, he kept his eyes fixed with hers the entire time. It felt daring and intimate, as if they were the only two people in the room. Lacey couldn't look away. She couldn't even breathe, and just as she started to regain her equilibrium, he lowered her into an elaborate dip. Intimate is a good choice of words here, because this is an intimate moment. Ballroom dancing is very much a time when two people have to be very close to one another, in tune with the other person's body and movements. And in one simple thing, both of our characters built up their expectations of their perception of one another and promptly had them shattered. And if I'm being honest, while I wouldn't put this scene high up in any kind of spice level, it hits the notes that it's supposed to hit, and it certainly has my attention. There's something so silly about it, practically cliche, to the point where it loops all the way back around into sincerity, and for some reason, I'm here for it. The dance ends, and right on cue, Lacey has to pull the midnight escape, complete with loss of shoe, and she has to tangle with what just happened. Meanwhile, Henry and Rose leave the castle where their valet/bodyguard Ian meets up with them. We get a large view of the theme park, all its various rides and represented fairy tales. I guess it was a little jarring for me as the author grabs stories that haven't been used as much as her real-life inspiration, but she does get away with one tale or two, one specifically referencing the Snow Queen in its original form. As he surveys the fairy tale world, his mind goes back to his own supposed fairy tale romance, his late wife Jolie. There had been some rocky waters, though. Before she had gotten sick, Henry and Jolie had been falling out of love. But when she got the diagnosis, they didn't mention it again, and then she died. What had resulted was a crown prince who had been thoroughly disenchanted of the whole concept of marriage. So when Rose regaled to Ian about Henry's dance with the princess, it brings out Henry's inner cynic. But despite it all, Henry had enjoyed his little waltz. He was so used to people deferring to him as the crown prince, so it had been refreshing, if not thrilling, to see this Princess Sweet Pea challenge him. Hindsight, however, had him hoping that no one in the room recognized him and pulled out their phones for a video or picture. Ian is quickly becoming one of my favorite characters, though. He's got a sweet rapport with Rose, and his relationship with Henry feels more like brothers than bodyguard in charge. He gets some in-light teasing with Henry about trying to chase down the mysterious maiden with her shoe and happily goes along with whatever Rose wants him to do. I want to see Ian's romance. I bet that would be fun. Anyway, Lacey is back home at her apartment, eating Chinese takeout with Ava, and they're spilling tea over the latest hot goss that the entertainment department has to offer. Mostly about who's dating who, and an engagement between two dwarves in the only actual direct reference to Disney, Sneezy and Doc. Ava also brings the rumor that someone big is coming to visit the park, after having heard that park leadership has pulled the highest seniority VIP tour guide to prepare. They have a giggle at guessing who it could be, but neither one even comes close. As she's getting ready for her shift the next day, the deets drop on the mystery visitor, none other than the Crown Prince of Bella Moritz, here to celebrate his daughter's 7th birthday. Lacey remembers a few things that she's heard about that royal family, namely how she saw tabloids reporting on the death of Prince Henry's wife several years ago. She wonders what it would be like to meet actual royalty. Certainly it would be nothing like her interaction with Grumpy Ballcap yesterday, right? Ha ha ha. After a perfectly normal run of Sweet Pea's tea party, Lacey is surprised to find the park's general manager waiting for her in the backstage halls, asking her to come with him. He's being extraordinarily vague about what's going on, talking about plans and little girls dressed up as Sweet Pea, and Lacey has no idea what is going on. If it were me, I'd be shaking in my boots. General manager doesn't sound like a super high position, but in the parks, it's a little bit of a big deal. I never crossed paths with any of the park general managers, and frankly, I hoped to keep it that way. Even talking with the next guy down on the ladder, the head of my particular department at the time, spooked me enough to keep away from most of the top leaders in the park. When the manager, Simon, finally pushes Lacey through the doors of a stupidly extravagant office with crazy views of the park, she sees none other than Grumpy Ballcap and his daughter dressed in a sweet pea dress. Simon plays it perfectly, introducing Lacey as the princess proper, not as herself, saying how wonderful it would be for Sweet Pea to be their guide for the next 4 days in the park. Okay, so this is another one of those things that would never, ever happen at the IRL parks. Remember what I said about character integrity? Namely, a big rule is that one character cannot be in two places at once. For example, when, let's say, Snow White is meeting guests, she has to leave to join the parade and can only return to the guests when she's done. The two events cannot happen simultaneously. By placing Sweet Pea with a highly visible VIP guest, it kind of screws with the illusion, but that's a nitpick. The big thing here is that I'm assuming, like the Disney parks, they have an entire department of tour guides for this purpose. People pay a lot, and I mean a lot of money, for that individualized experience, and the cast members are well trained for that role. These guides spend hours with their guest, possibly over the course of several days, and they have to be on every second of every moment. While Lacey has a similar role, to be on all the time, it's a different mental load. Characters get a lot of time to decompress during their day, often 20 or 30 minutes on and then 20 or 30 minutes off, depending on the season. It's a radically different skill set, and Lacey has zero training on being a VIP guide. And the guides don't have to be anyone they're not, either. Sure, they might put on the work face, as it were, but they don't have to act as a well-known character to protect character integrity. Personally, if I were Lacey, I'd be after Simon's head for the stunt. Lacey is, of course, terrified. Her mask slips for just a second, and Henry can see it. He even told Simon it wasn't necessary to have a princess guide. A regular VIP cast member would suffice. Hell, it looks as though he'd prefer no guide at all, as much to give normalcy as possible to Rose, but both his bodyguard and Simon wouldn't hear of it. He is royalty, and technically, they need handlers, supervision, and protection. Their day begins, and after a few rides, Henry manages to get a few quiet words in with Lacey. She has to dance on that line between herself and the princess, but she does manage a little honesty, admitting that she'd been out of sorts when she challenged him at the waltz. He asks her to call him Henry, and he asks for her real name. Blowing the most important rule of all right out of the water, she tells him, stressing that it needs to be their secret because, again, rules. They have a fun-filled day of rides, and during a moment of downtime in which ice creams are had, Lacey spots another young girl in line for a boat ride. She's in a wheelchair and dressed up just like Sweet Pea, except without a crown. Henry sees Lacey notice the girl and knows that if she hadn't been assigned to them, she'd be over there already. While Rose is momentarily distracted by ice cream and Ian, Henry gives Lacey the push to go and see the child. It's another great show-don't-tell moment for the story, and made all the better when Rose notices and sees that the girl doesn't have a crown. She runs over and gives the girl her own little princess tiara. This is sweeter than those ice creams, and I can't handle it. We then get a customary friend check-in, where Lacey talks to Ava about her day when all is said and done, and Ava accuses her of liking the prince. I mean, it's literally only been one day, and she's fresh off a breakup, but sure. Meanwhile, Henry is settling Rose into bed at their hotel room, and this gets pretty cheesy here. Lacey had given Rose the Princess and the Pea storybook as a birthday gift, complete with a Princess Sweet Pea autograph, and Rose wanted it read to her for her bedtime story. Henry obliges, and cheesy slides into corny when he reads that the storybook prince was lonely, and Rose asks him if he's lonely. It is exactly the sort of interaction that I would expect to see in a Hallmark romance. The next day at the park finds the whole royal group with more fun, including a top-tier viewing spot for the parade, and Henry and Lacey get another stolen moment in reality. He notices that she seems introspective, and she admits that she was thinking about her mother. Henry follows up with the obvious question about her parents, and instead of deflecting like she should have, she tells him the story of how her mother had died from leukemia when she was a little girl. She tells him that the experience is what inspired her to become a theme park princess, when she would see visiting characters in the hospital while her mom was getting care. She also admits that it's probably why she's able to have such a strong kinship with Rose. After the parade and some lunch, Rose and Lacey spot a bird that had been caught in the grass by some gum, I guess, and Lacey works to help free it, giving us as close to a fairy tale moment as we could possibly get. Henry is practically beside himself, thinking, this can't be real. He wonders where the fairy tale ends and Lacey begins. An excellent question. This is kind of a big point for me because it's a fair question to ask. Lacey is, again, playing a role. She's not playing Lacey right now, and Henry is having a hard time trying to figure out which is which. I think the point here is to show us that Lacey might as well be Princess Sweet Pea because she is very much devoted to this role. Again, remember her introduction. But there is a small concern that Henry might fall in love with someone who isn't real. Not to mention she's technically working for him right now. He is fully aware that it might get a little dicey. After a dizzying ride in the teacups, Rose is all for another round, but Henry sees that Lacey looks a little dizzy. Ian suggests that he go on the teacups with Rose while Henry and Lacey go to do something tamer, perhaps the Ferris wheel. They get to enjoy a moment together, with Henry trying to remind himself that he and Lacey were only friends. He opens up about Rose's trouble with the horses and the upcoming flower festival, and Lacey is perfectly sympathetic. After we watch another evening of Lacey and Henry in their respective habitats outside the park, it's time for the last day of the royal vacation. The morning brings a surprise, as Lacey leads them to the carousel with all its decorated prancing horses. Henry knows immediately what's up, and it's tugging at the heartstrings something fierce. As a way to transition Rose back into riding, Lacey has decided to introduce her to some fake ones first, and it looks to have been a resounding success. They go four rounds on the carousel, and by the end, Rose is as happy as can be. Then, Lacey has herself a revelation.
"What?" Henry said, narrowing his gaze at her. "Is something wrong?"
"No, I just realized that you're..." She dropped her voice to a whisper. "Well, you're a prince, and you're riding a white horse right now." Her bow-shaped lips tipped into a frown.
"Too cliché?"
Henry asked, a smile tugging at the corner of his mouth. "Not at all. Someone recently told me a prince wasn't about to come charging into my life on a white horse, and yet, here you are." Lacey blinked.
"Here I am."
While Henry is still coming to terms with the fact that he might be developing feelings for Lacey, she is terrified that she keeps putting her glass-slippered foot into her mouth. The situation on the carousel had sharply reminded her of Mark's parting words, and she kept worrying that she was letting her feelings get out of control. This is where I would usually pop in with how important communication is, but our two lovebirds have a good reason to not want to confess anything. Henry is a literal crown prince, and he has got a lot on his plate, a fact that both of them are acutely aware of. It's easy to get swept away in this fairy tale cotton candy fever dream of a theme park, and they both tell themselves they need to slow their roll. As they make their way to the next ride, a pirate boat ride, Henry asks Rose if he can sit with the princess this time. Determined to be a good wingman, Ian tells Rose that he and Henry wouldn't fit in one boat together anyway, so Rose rides with Ian, and Henry gets some alone time with Lacey. He wanted to thank her for everything for the past couple of days, for how much this time meant to him and Rose, but their close quarters and the supposed privacy makes Henry a little bold. He and Lacey get drawn closer and closer together, almost ready to kiss, and... Henry sees a flash out of the corner of his eye. Frightened that it might have been a cell phone camera, he pulls away right before they kiss, seemingly coming to his senses and looking around for the flash. Lacey's a little shook, but she takes it in stride, laughing it off, pointing out characters in the ride. After they disembark, they go outside just in time to see the fireworks go off. While Rose is enchanted by the show, Henry shoots his shot. He invites Lacey to attend the flower festival in Bella Moritz.
She's surprised by the gesture, and he tries to make it more appealing to her, covering all of her travel expenses, saying that they could attend the ball together as friends, and extending the invitation to her friend Ava. It's a good call inviting Ava, royal prince or not, flying alone abroad to hang out with a guy you've only known for 4 days is a big fat no-go. The buddy system works, people. Also, points for sponsoring the impromptu trip. I can confidently say that a good portion of cast members would not have had the cash to drop on an international trip for a party only 2-ish weeks away, not unless they came for money themselves or had a spouse with a hell of an income. Ava is thrilled, of course, and she and Lacey borrow some ball gowns from another cast member, a former pageant competitor turned fairy godmother. Lacey finds the perfect dress, and she gets an email from Henry telling her that all of the arrangements have been made. He has signed it with 2 little X's, and it's just so cute, leaving Lacey to agonize over its possible meaning. We catch up with Henry at the palace, and we see him butt heads with his mother a little bit. The Queen of Belemerites is almost what you'd expect from a story like this, a firm hand in all things royal and traditional. Like we saw at the beginning, she's been putting pressure on Henry to get Rose ready for her role as a princess. Everything from preparing for the flower festival to chastising Henry for letting her get attached to a fictional princess. I smell a possible conflict here. The queen doesn't yet know that Henry has invited Lacey to the flower festival and accompanying ball, but I'm slightly concerned we're going to get into overprotective mom and queen when she does show up. Henry and Lacey both go about their lives for the next couple of days, Henry doing crown prince things and Lacey doing theme park princess things. There's a cute moment of text flirting, sending Lacey into another session of, what does this mean? Are we friends? What's with the little X's? Again, it's cute. These texts blossom into further conversations where they learn more about each other. We are told this, unfortunately, but at least we can know that Henry and Lacey are exploring their relationship beyond spending time at the park. The queen talks to Henry about the ball, informing him that on the guest list, she's included a number of possible eligible matches. Of course, Henry isn't thrilled, so he tells his mother that he's already invited Lacey. He doesn't say that he's courting her, not out loud, but he does tell the queen that he won't need her list of bachelorettes. Finally, Lacey arrives in Belemerites, dressed in tow and Ava at her side. She's trying to keep herself from completely swooning, telling herself that she's not Henry's girlfriend, but she's not doing a good job of convincing herself, or Ava. Ava tells her to relax for now, to just enjoy the moment. The driver that picks them up from the airport is a friendly fellow, giving us a rundown of what to expect over the next couple of days. There will be vendors selling delights galore, the royal greenhouse will be open and decked, there will be the flower parade in 2 days, and then the day after the parade, the grand ball as a finale. I'm excited, are you excited? And I get a little treat of my own. As Lacey and Ava pull up to the castle, with Lacey practically swooning again with the scenery, Ava gets a gander at Ian as he accompanies Henry and Rose. She is immediately smitten, and I am thrilled that I might actually get to see a romance for Ian after all. Henry helps get Lacey and Ava settled into their room, Lacey doing what she can to orient herself in these opulent accommodations, and that's when the queen arrives. Rose is delighted to make introductions in her special childlike way, telling her grandmother that this was Princess Sweet Pea, but her secret princess name was Lacey. Really, this story is so sweet, I have to keep my teeth from getting cavities. Poor Lacey. She gets hit with a bout of theme park muscle memory and drops into her Sweet Pea curtsy. I can completely understand her mortification. That theme park training runs deep for some reason. It took me a solid month to stop using magical greetings at my first non-theme park job. In some ways, I am still deprogramming some of that language. But the queen didn't have time to stick around. She needed to inform Henry of some urgent news. He's reluctantly whisked away, and his mother shows him a photograph. He's been caught on camera with Lacey on the Ferris wheel back at Once Upon a Time. The press had been holding on to the photo, waiting to release it at just the right time, and had sent it along to the palace asking for comment. Henry wants to say that there is no comment, but the queen isn't satisfied. Henry hasn't been seen with a woman in years, and now he's invited Lacey to the palace only days after this picture had been taken. The queen suggests that they say Lacey is a special acquaintance of Rose, which is partly the truth, but Henry isn't sure that that's how he feels about it. The next day, after a stressful breakfast with everyone, including the Queen, Henry and Lacey have their first proper date. Well, they don't call it a date, of course, but that's what's happening for sure. After 4 days of seeing how Sweet Pea ruled and ran her kingdom, Henry decides to show Lacey some of the more fun parts of being royalty, like how to do a proper royal wave and riding horse-drawn carriages. Finally, their time together ends in a receiving hall, where Henry shows Lacey how the knighting ceremony works. "Wow," she said, and as gently as she could, she lifted the sword and tapped the blade against one of Henry's shoulders and then the other. "I dub thee, Henry, Prince of my heart." He smiled at her and rose to his feet, and suddenly he was so close. Too close. They'd been having such a fun, goofy time all afternoon, but underneath all the flirty banter, there was a new sense of tenderness between them. At times, Lacey wanted to close her eyes and just lean into it, but then she'd remember who they both were. She and Henry were like flip sides of a coin, so similar, so familiar, but different in a way that meant they'd never meet on the same side. Lacey is swept up into the moment, and she admits to him how her trip here is a mirror image of his trip to Florida, and she's trying to reconcile the facsimile of the theme park with the reality of his life. In possibly the most swoon-worthy line of the entire novel, Henry tells her, "Oh, princess, don't you know by now? It's all been real for me." I swear to God, this novel is dragging my inner Starbucks drinking, soccer mom carting, Target shopping white woman to the surface from where I desperately try to keep that lunatic buried, because dear Lord, that had me fawning God knows why. A footman comes to tell Henry he is needed with Rose for her riding lesson, and he reluctantly has to dash off. Drat that footman's timing, they were just about to kiss again. Things get really interesting the next day. First, little Rose is late to breakfast. It seems that she had tried to fulfill one of Princess Sweet Pea's rules of royalty, never taking off your crown even in a bubble bath. Lacey is mortified, of course, these are real crowns, not plastic tiaras, and Henry has to stop himself from smiling. Then it's discovered that someone's been in the greenhouse, setting up butterfly feeders. The flowers hadn't been blooming as well as they should have been, and there was concern since the greenhouse tended to be a big deal at the flower festival. Lacey doesn't own up to it, of course, but Henry knows that she had brought the butterflies in to help the festival. And now he comes to terms with it. Lacey is exactly who he has been waiting for. The day of the ever-important parade arrives then, and Henry catches up with Lacey for a moment. He's dressed in full regalia, nearly distracting her from the very real problem that he's brought. The photo of them hadn't gone public yet, but he wanted to warn her in that he'd help her through it. Her mind is all over the place, and before she can say anything about the statement he needs to make, Ava shows up. The conversation switches rather quickly to the problem of Rose and her fear of riding. The three of them have the sudden brainstorm of dressing her pony up in ribbons and flowers to make her look like a carousel horse. Quickly, they all go to the stables to make it happen, and they are rewarded with the sight of Rose prancing happily on her pony next to Henry and his stallion. That evening, my anxiety shoots up to 11 when the Queen comes to call at Lacey's door. I am so familiar with the trope of the overbearing royal parent disapproving of their offspring's choice of partner, but we don't get that here. Sure, Lacey is scared stiff of the Queen, I would be too, but she's come to see Lacey about Rose and the parade. She asks about the idea of the ribbons and flowers, but Lacey doesn't want to take credit for the idea. She tells the Queen that the credit should all go to Rose for her bravery and to Henry wanting the best for his daughter. My relief turns into surprise when we see Henry the next day, confessing to his mother that he loves Lacey and that he can't make a statement on the photo just yet. And she doesn't fight him on it, even telling him to be mindful of Lacey's feelings. Not only is the trope of the angry Queen mother so tired, but really, one would hope that a monarch would be able to approach this topic with grace and understanding. I mean, I know which I would prefer, and I'm very happy to see it here. As Lacey gets ready for the ball, she gets a surprise call from Mark, giving her a heads up about his upcoming engagement announcement to someone he knew in college, and apologizing to her about what he had said. She wishes him well, and then gets back to unzipping her dress from the garment bag. Except it's not the borrowed ball gown. It's her princess costume from Once Upon a Time. I'm going to ignore that, again, this would have never happened IRL for a number of reasons, and stress out as I watch Lacey go into a sort of imposter syndrome spiral. She wasn't right for Mark, and now she is certainly not right for Henry, and that's what she says. Worst of all, she can't even go to the ball anymore. She's got nothing suitable to wear. She writes a tear-soaked letter apologizing to Henry and to say goodbye. She hands it to the maid that was assigned to her and accepts that her fairy tale was over. As Lacey is spiraling, trying to figure out if she should just chuck all of her things into a suitcase, pondering if they even had Uber in Bella Moritz, the queen arrives, decked out for the ball and holding Lacey's letter in her hands. She tells Lacey that instead of taking the letter to Henry, the maid had brought it to her instead, knowing that something was dearly wrong. And she transforms from proper and regal monarch to a warm and kind mother figure. She has an open heart-to-heart with Lacey, saying that Henry had become happier, lighter in her presence, and that she was not about to let Lacey slip away now. Lacey argues a bit, saying that she's a commoner. The queen assures Lacey that anyone can tell she is anything but common. She references Sweet Pea's royal rules, telling Lacey that those rules aren't just pretend, but instead come from a place of sincerity and authenticity. Simply put, Lacey is true to herself, and there's nothing else better she could be. I'm not gonna lie, something hit me here. Like I said before, cast members are something else. They live and breathe the roles that they play, even if they're not putting on crowns and puffy dresses. They put their whole selves into their job, and to see someone recognize that, someone outside of the company who has no frame of reference for who they are as a person, well, it's validating. At any rate, Lacey is drinking up this validation, but there's still the problem of the dress. But she's an actual real-life castle. I am sure the two of them can scrounge something up. Meanwhile, Henry's been anxiously awaiting Lacey's arrival, and as the time clicked on, he felt more and more like the prince waiting around after midnight. Just as he's about to send Ava and Ian on a search and rescue, Lacey arrives. Henry clutched his heart beneath the smooth silk lapels on his white tie and tails. "I was beginning to think you'd pulled another Cinderella on me." He barely managed to get the words out. His breath hitched in his throat at the sight of her, dressed in an airy, pale blue ball gown, spun from delicate netting and dotted with tiny crystals and sequins so luminous the fabric seemed to shimmer as if it had been dipped in fairy dust. He took a closer look at the crown, and tenderness wrapped his way around his heart. So that was where the queen had been earlier. Instead of greeting their guests, his mother had been with Lacey, loaning her a tiara for the evening, a symbol of her acceptance of the woman who had claimed Henry's heart. I think the sincerity of this novel might actually kill me. Henry and Lacey are announced together to join the ball, and Henry dances with her, using the exact same song they'd waltzed to during the tea party at Once Upon a Time. Then, when it's finished, they confess their love for one another. Henry asks Lacey to marry him, and she says yes, right as the clock struck midnight. Happily ever after, indeed. And I have to admit, I didn't see this coming. I mean, my own feelings for the novel, I mean. Not the happy ending that I saw a mile away. Because Once Upon a Royal Summer hooked me in a way that I never expected to see in a romance novel. It was a wild fantasy for sure, but it pushed every button that I thought I had long ago buried. Before I run away with this idea, though, let's get into Heather's final score. Okay, the cover first, and I'm going to be really generous here and give it a 5 out of 5. I love everything about it, and it tells us exactly what we are going to find. If it's not the color theory at work, it's the cotton candy holding princess with a bright, hopeful smile. It sets just the right tone for the story that we are going to be reading. As for drama, I'm going to give that a 3 out of 5. We don't exactly have high stakes, but there is a very real personal drama happening between Lacey and Henry. And then we throw in the Queen and Rose to the mix. Henry is doing everything that he can to give Rose a sense of normalcy, sending her to public school, taking her to theme parks on vacation, giving her a chance to rest and prepare for the flower festival parade. Watching Lacey go from theme park princess to experiencing real royalty was endearing, if a little silly. And there's big air quotes around that real, but we'll get to that. Romance is, shockingly, a 4 out of 5. I know I tend to look down on the super fast romances like this one, and I was even a little dubious when I read this novel on the first go around, but through the second and third reads, I found a sincerity that I couldn't ignore. Lacey and Henry felt like actual, tangible people. I related to Lacey, obviously, and Henry felt like any dad who wants the best for his kid, royal or not. While they didn't have a lot of time with each other, they made good use of whatever time they did have. Sure, it might have been a fast-tracked romance, but we got to watch their feeling blossoms organically, without any contrived nonsense because the author said so. Spice is, well, let's be real here, that's a flat 1 out of 5. They don't even kiss until Lacey says she'll marry him, so there isn't really a lot to work with here on that front. Finally, realism is getting a 2 out of 5, and I'm being generous here. When I'm comparing my time as a cast member to Lacey's experience as a cast member for her part, there was a surprisingly large amount of accuracy. There were those glaring, oh, that'll never happen moments, of course, but the author had done her research. Heck, I wouldn't be surprised if she had done time as a cast member herself. Everything else, though, is wildly out of the realms of reality. Another point in the novel's favor, though, was Bella Moritz. Yes, it's a fake kingdom, but I could easily see it in my mind's eye. It may not have been a real place, but it felt realistic, even if the way it was run was a little fairy tale-ish. Maybe I've just watched too many princess movies. So, looking at all of these scores, they're kind of all over the place, high in some spots, low in others. But really, none of those matter. What I cared about most of all when I closed that cover for the first or second time was how much I enjoyed the story. And I'd be a damn liar if I said I didn't enjoy it. I mean, what else really matters at the end of the day? I don't have the entire Twilight series on my bookshelf because I think it's the peak of literature. I don't watch The Princess Diaries 2 over and over again because I believe it adds unquestionable quality to the whole of cinema. And I certainly didn't put on that name tag and wished people to have a magical day because I thought it would make me rich. I did it because I loved it. In a weird way, this novel reminded me of that love, of what I left behind when I moved out of Florida. And I had fun the entire time reading. You might be surprised with this judgment, and I'm even a little surprised myself. But for my final score, Once Upon a Royal Summer will take its place on the Gold Star shelf with 5 flower-decorated ponies out of 5. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Yin Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an Age with K production. And it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.